Last week, CERN announced that a new subatomic particle had been observed at the Large Hadron Collider after 50 years of searching for it. The discovery is important to our understanding of the strong interaction, one of the four fundamental interactions of nature. For over 40 years, MIT theoretical physicist and Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek has studied the strong interaction and the structure of our universe at the smallest scale. His latest book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design, delves into how new discoveries like this are part of a long history of scientific quests for a beautiful order in nature. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Frank Wilczek back to our show. Hello.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
The CERN announcement said in part that pentaquark charmonium states must be formed of two up quarks, one down quark, one charm quark, and one anti-charm quark. Can that be translated into comprehensible English?
Well, we can put it in context, and then you can decide if it's comprehensible. The strongly interacting particles, of which protons and neutrons are the most practical examples, those are what atomic nuclei and ultimately we are made out of. But the protons and neutrons are only two examples of a much wider class of structures that we understand are made out of more fundamental things that obey much simpler principles and equations called quarks and gluons. Now, all the particles basically that have been studied up until now, and there are hundreds of them, conform to two body plans. There are things called baryons that are made from three quarks, and there are things called mesons that are made from a quark and an antiquark. There are also antibaryons, but the same idea. Now, this would be a new body plan that the quarks could organize themselves into.
Do we keep on getting smaller and smaller? I remember when Murray Gell-Mann was here and he talked about coming up with the idea of the quark, but that seemed to be the smallest thing at the time.
Well, as far as we know, quarks are basically ideal mathematical points in the equations. They acquire structure because quantum mechanical particles are described by probability clouds, but as objects, they are points. Now, we've discovered more things since those days. We had gluons emerging from understanding how the forces between quarks work. That was my contribution. But they're not in any real sense smaller. They're just different.
How does this CERN discovery connect with your work? Or
well,
does it?
Oh, it very much does. And the fact that you get from the fundamental description, quantum chromodynamics, that's the equations that I found, to these two body plans is not at all obvious and, in fact, is not very well understood why those two body plans are so dominant. Although we can solve these equations accurately in some circumstances, the behavior of quarks at low energies when they form these protons and neutrons and other strongly interacting particles is very difficult to calculate. And so we need the help of experiment to guide us in getting the consequences of these equations. And it's very interesting that the experiments are coughing up these new body plans. There actually was a false alarm about pentaquarks, this kind of thing, several years ago that inspired quite a bit of work, including by me. And
a false alarm in what way?
Well, there was a supposed discovery of something with this body plan that was very dramatic. Several different experimental groups around the world claimed to confirm it, but other ones couldn't find this particle. And make a long story short, eventually it was discredited. But now this is not the same particle. This is a different particle, but the same kind of body plan. And the ideas, I think, that we were exploring in the earlier incarnation, which had very great difficulty in describing what they supposedly were seeing, which in retrospect looks really good because they weren't seeing it. They look much better, I think, in this context, as and therefore the world that we thought we had before we may get now, and it'll be very interesting. It'll teach us also about the forces that are operative in protons and neutrons and about matter in it. It'll improve our understanding, give us a whole new world to explore.
You shared the Nobel Prize with David Gross and David Pulitzer for your work on asymptotic freedom, a feature of quantum chromodynamics. Can asymptotic freedom be described for people who might find high school physics intimidating?
It's actually, yes. It's very simple to understand. To define if your standards are low enough. So basically, it's the phenomenon that the force between quarks gets weaker at short distances or at high energies, but conversely gets stronger as you go to larger distances or consider interactions at low energy.
That seems counterintuitive.
It's very counterintuitive. It's very hard to make a theoretical description that has that property that is consistent with other basic principles of quantum theory and relativity. In fact, it's so hard that it was by finding theories that embodied that property that we were led to a unique theory of the strong interaction, which is called quantum chromodynamics, which we introduced gluons so that this could happen. And it's had a glorious, triumphant history since then.
Well, often people come up with an idea, there's got to be this thing.
Yes.
And then we don't know if it actually does exist until experiments many years later. The CERN Large Hadron Collider has been very helpful, hasn't it?
The CERN Hadron Collider, the Large Hadron Collider in particular, sort of has been operating just the last few years.
So or other colliders,
for us,
anyway.
Other colliders have been very important. The story that's meant a lot to me is that in the early days when people were doing experiments using our theory, it was called testing quantum chromodynamics or testing asymptotic freedom. Now, when they do the same sort of thing, it's called calculating backgrounds. So this now is so accepted that it's used as a kind of background that people want to say, that's understood, we want to find new things, so we'll rely on that part and look for small discrepancies. And that's the way, for instance, the Higgs particle was found at the LHC. It would have been completely inconceivable if you didn't understand what happens most of the time, which is the strong interaction, which is quantum chromodynamics, to find these rare events that correspond to the new physics, the Higgs particle. I like to say it's like if you want to find a needle in a haystack, you have to understand hay very well.
My guest is Frank Wilczek, who understands hay very well. His latest book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design, it's published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned earlier attempts to find some kind of grand unified theory. Does this discovery help in that effort?
The pentaquarks, not particularly. The Higgs particle, yes. The pentaquarks will add to our understanding of the equations we have, but won't lead to fundamentally new equations.
String theory is an attempt. I'm sorry.
Yeah, string. Well, there are a big goal of the next generation of experiments, sort of gearing up at the LHC, is to see whether ideas that extend our current understanding, which is usually called the standard model. I like to call it the core theory. Whether those ideas, which are inspired by trying to make the equations more beautiful, more compelling, more unified, whether those are correct.
We'll come back to that beautiful in just a moment. But in speaking to string theorists, I've often been confused. They keep on coming up with a different number of dimensions that are necessary. And then that whole issue of whether string theory is even something that is testable. Do you think that the Large Hadron Collider will provide a way to test string theory one way or the other?
I would be very surprised, because the theory as yet hasn't been mature enough to give concrete predictions. There could be encouragement if something called supersymmetry is discovered. That's something that string theory uses as a kind of building block, but it can be motivated on other grounds. So that would be encouragement, but not proof. It would be a big step forward in any case.
Why are physicists so interested in unification? The world seems to be working quite well with these two theories that have both been proven to be true, even if they're slightly irreconcilable.
Are you speaking of quantum mechanics and gravity?
Yes.
Well, actually, there are more theories. There's also the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions. And I think the conflict between gravity and quantum mechanics is overstated. I mean, and the other interactions. The astrophysicists routinely deal with situations in which gravity is operated, and so is quantum mechanics, and they're very successful using the laws of physics. However, the general quest for unification is an important quest. I would say there are two reasons why we especially seek unification of different forces that seem superficially quite different. One is that it's had a glorious history. In the past, for instance, when Maxwell unified electricity and magnetism, he found that the unified theory predicted new phenomena, which are phenomena that today we call radio, infrared radiation, microwaves. You know, today we cook with them and communicate with them. So that was extremely fruitful, and it gave a new understanding of light. And there have been other episodes like that, when unifying diverse things, just as an aesthetic enterprise, turned out to give great fruit. The other reason, besides that it's fruitful, is just that it's pretty. And what else are we going to do? We need to have some thing that drives the quest for getting a better description of nature. And trying to get a unified description has one guess for how that might work that's been fruitful in the past. And there seems to be a lot of circumstantial evidence that we can make a few more steps.
Was Maxwell searching for unification, or was it more of a flash of insight that he realized had the effect of unifying?
Well, he was searching for a unification of the laws of electricity and magnetism. So at that time, the understanding of electricity and magnetism was still partial. There were important links between them. People knew that electric currents produce magnetic fields, and Faraday's law that changing magnetic fields produce electric fields. What Maxwell wanted to do was make a systematic, complete understanding of electricity and magnetism. So in that sense, he was seeking a unification of the diverse laws that were known at that time. What he found, however, is that when he tried to do that, he got an inconsistency. He figured out how to fix that, though, in a simple way that seemed very beautiful and compelling. And when he did that, he found, as an unexpected gift, that disturbances in the electric and magnetic fields could take on a life of their own, move around, that they would move around at the speed of light. And so Maxwell said, that is light. And that was a completely unexpected, glorious unification of electricity, magnetism, and light.
You keep on using these words, pretty and beautiful. The big question you ask in your book is, does the universe embody beautiful ideas?
Yes.
Can you give an example of an idea in quantum chromodynamics or another area of modern physics that you find particularly beautiful?
Well, a common theme in our understanding of the fundamental laws, and that have been so successful, and especially in the last part of the 20th century, and the way we guess them, in fact, is by hoping that they embody a principle of symmetry. Now, symmetry, as used in mathematics and physics, is a special concept. It's the concept you can change things without changing them. So, for instance, a circle, which we call is very symmetric intuitively, in this definition is also symmetric because you can rotate a circle by any angle, and although the different points move, so it's changed, the circle as a whole does not. Now, the virtue of that kind of exotic-seeming definition is that it's precise and can be generalized. So you can speak of symmetry of equations if their equations allow transformations of the different quantities that don't change their content, or symmetries of physical law, if you can transform things without changing the law.
So the symmetries are what make things beautiful? Things that work well but are also ugly?
Well, I mean, symmetry has worked well, amazingly well, because the symmetries that we need, that we postulate in quantum chromodynamics, for instance, are extraordinarily large amounts of symmetry. The equations allow many, many kinds of transformations that are amazing, that leave their content invariant. And that's how we arrived at them. Now, there are, however, loose ends. And one way that I and my colleagues are trying to improve the description of nature is by making more symmetric equations. So one way of making more symmetric equations to make them reverse, have the same properties in going forward in time and backwards in time, leads to a particle called axions, which might be the dark matter of the universe. Another way of making the equations more symmetric and beautiful makes the strong electromagnetic and weak interactions all derive from one fundamental interaction at short distances. That requires supersymmetry, which again brings in new particles. So these lead to testable consequences. And I'm hoping that trust in beauty as a guide to the way nature should behave will actually teach us how nature does behave. And the jury is out. The experiments are being done, but we'll find out soon.
My guest is Frank Wilczek, Wilczek, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004. He's written a number of books. His most recent, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design. It's published by Penguin Press. We'll continue a conversation after this. We're back with Frank Wilczek. His latest book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design, is published by Penguin Press. I want to get back to this whole thing about beauty. Don't some physical constants like the speed of light or Planck's constant extend to many decimal places? Would that be considered ugly?
You mean that?
I mean,
what
just
else
go on and on and on.
The way that those are defined, when I think of Planck's constant, or when I think of the speed of light, I think of them as being equal to one. Planck's constant defines the unit of action, the thing that dimension it has. The speed of light, it's easier to talk about in terms of the speed of light. The speed of light is a velocity. If you measure velocities in terms of that fundamental velocity, then the speed of light is just one. So for a physicist, all those decimal places are not important. They just have to do with the fact that you're defining it in terms of seconds and centimeters, and those things are very unnatural. Those are just conventions. What the important thing, the fundamental thing, is the speed of light itself. And in practice, we always just set it to one and measure velocities in those units.
Your colleague David Gross described the ugly parts as those that, quote, describe the strange spectrum of matter. And he added that it was the lack of beauty with a large number of unexplained parameters that leads many to believe that the end of the story has not been reached. How far has the story been advanced since he wrote that in 1988?
I think that what's happened since 1988 is mostly that we've discovered how good our description of nature that we saw at that time is. Many people, including myself, who didn't anticipate that the ideas that we hatched in the late 70s, or I'm sorry, the 70s and the early 80s, would hold up as well as they have. And experimentalists have tried very, very hard to find exceptions, to find new phenomena at higher energies or in precise measurements. But so far, the basic framework has held up remarkably well. There are a couple of major loose ends. One is that the astronomers, meanwhile, have found dark matter, have found a form of matter that's not within our core theory or standard model. Another thing that's happened is that they found dark energy, which is yet another thing that's not in our standard model or is can be accommodated, but is kind of strange. And the discovery of the Higgs particle was kind of the last missing piece of the theory we had before. So it was a wonderful confirmation of previous ideas. Now,
I've always wondered what would happen if we weren't able to discover the Higgs boson.
Well, there were plenty of proposals for things that might have been there instead of extra dimensions or warped things or technicolor. There are many proposals or more complicated versions with several Higgs particles. But what's happened is the kind of very minimal implementation of the job that the Higgs particle was supposed to do has turned out to be the correct description so far of what experimentists have found. So basically what's happened, I would say, since David's statement is that the situation has sharpened. We now know that the laws, the beautiful laws that we saw at that time work very, very well. The ugly parts still are ugly. There are loose ends. But aesthetics, to me, is the guide, the most promising guide to what will happen next. And so I'm hoping that the axion and that supersymmetry, which are both inspired by aesthetic completions of what we know now, will turn out to be the next wave of discoveries.
Most people associate physics with mathematics, but are the ideas you discuss in your book necessarily mathematical?
Well, they're mathematical in the sense that they're precise. However, I've not put in any equations. I've tried to, and I think succeeded, in describing them all in visual terms. So, for instance, even the Maxwell equations, which are famously complicated with partial differential equations or integrals and so forth, you can put in with complete justice and accuracy in simple visual terms. And I worked very hard to do that. I learned how to draw using Keynote and made the figures and had, more importantly, thought of the concepts that would be necessary to bring it into pictures. And even in the case of QCD, which is kind of Maxwell's equations on steroids, I've used imagery, color, tried to call into, use the overwhelming abilities of humans as visual creatures to understand the concepts in ways that are intensely visual as opposed to abstract algebra.
An MIT colleague of yours, Max Tegmark, has argued that reality is mathematics. Do you share his view?
No. Reality is reality, and mathematics is mathematics. And there are, of course, some quite remarkable correspondences between parts of mathematics and parts of reality, but there's certainly not an identity between the two, as far as I can tell. That's kind of mystical.
How is a physicist's notion of beauty like the common notion of beauty that we have when we talk about art or music?
Well, one thing I've tried to document in A Beautiful Question, which in fact to me is the main burden of the book, is to show that properly understood, when you put it in visual terms, when you analyze the conceptual core of our fundamental understanding of the world in terms of symmetry and also what I call exuberance, the idea that you get more out than you put in, that there's an economy of means, that those are powerful themes that you, and also playing with color, by the way, that those are powerful themes that you find in the history of art and philosophy as well. These are kinds of ideas that were anticipated by Pythagoras and Plato. It's how they hoped the world would work and guessed. They made crude guesses for how these ideas might work. And artists have embodied it in decorative art especially. They use rich patterns of symmetry. And perspective is a form of symmetry that artists took great pride and joy in using and is essentially a mathematical discovery.
Golden mean.
There's the golden mean. So it was really a revelation when I started thinking hard about this, how much there's in common between what people have found beautiful in the that you can, it's objective, it's not subject. You can look at what the historical record is. What did people find beautiful and compare it with the basic principles of how the world works? Of course, not everything that people find beautiful is how the world works, and not everything about how the world works is beautiful, but there's enormous overlap. There's enormous commonality in those two things.
But art history reveals to us that what people find beautiful in the 15th century is different from what they find beautiful in the 17th century, and again, what we find beautiful in the 21st century. You do have color plates, some rather beautiful color plates in this book, including some by William Blake, and you quote Blake, "If the doors of perception could be cleansed, then man would see the world as it is, infinite."
Yes. Well, one thing that careful study and scientific study of nature reveals is that our sensory apparatus is profoundly limited. In some sense, this is well known. We don't see really small things. We need to use microscopes. We can't see really far away things. We need to use telescopes. However, the more you understand about how rich the underlying structure of the world is, the more you appreciate how much our perception of it leaves on the table. So in particular, our sense of vision is based on three color receptors, which are all in a certain part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And in principle, the electromagnetic spectrum, which is light, is a continuum. So you could support many, many more. You could also have infrared, ultraviolet, polarization. There's much that we leave on the table. And if we could clean up or enhance our perception, there's much more to the world than meets the eye. So Blake was absolutely right about that.
Physicists talk about color gluons.
Yes. Well, that was a joke originally. But it's actually an extremely profound metaphor that I've used heavily, because human vision being the trichromatic means that it's all the colors we see can be synthesized from three basic underlying colors. That's the principle of color television, computer displays, color photography, color printing. You can use three basic elements to get any perceived color. It turns out that there are three different properties you need to specify the properties of quarks and the different kinds of charges there are in quantum chromodynamics. So the name is profoundly resonant. And as I've explored the use of color as a metaphor for the strong interaction, it's almost uncanny how much of the physical nature of color can be mapped on to the perception of color if you use your imagination.
Getting back to the word beauty, were thinkers like Kepler or Galileo or Newton inspired by ideas about the beauty of the natural world?
Yes, definitely. Kepler, most obviously. Kepler's career in astronomy was based on a model that he thought was extremely beautiful, that we now know is entirely wrong, but it inspired him. Based on, he wanted to understand the size and shape of the solar system, so he thought that the planets revolved around on spherical carriers, and had circular orbits. And to determine the size of those carriers, what you would do is use the Platonic solids, these embodiments of symmetry that Plato had admired and made as models of atoms long before, use those as interpolating objects between the different celestial spheres. And to get them to fit, you need the spheres to be of a certain relative size. And Kepler thought, convinced himself, that that's what determined the number of planets and also the size and shape of their orbits.
So much of how we understood the world was based on Euclidean geometry for a long time. And then non-Euclidean geometry is developed in the 19th century. How can you does that mean that points can meet in infinity?
Well, to me, the real discovery of non-Euclidean geometry was in 1420 by the artist engineer Brunelleschi, who made the science of perception, of perspective.
He came up with it, then Masaccio applied it, and history and art history has never been the same.
That's right. And in perspective, parallel lines do meet. They meet. And if you look at a canvas and look at a picture, an accurate picture of railroad tracks, for instance, they meet at the horizon. It's a real place on the canvas. So this kind of art of perspective leads to a branch of geometry that's very well developed. It's called projective geometry. That's extremely beautiful. That's non-Euclidean.
And without it, we wouldn't have modern mathematics.
We would not have modern. We certainly wouldn't have the Renaissance art or modern mathematics. It's an important part of modern mathematics. It also, by the way, is a profound embodiment of symmetry in this sense of change without change, because it's the science, it's the precise science of how you can change images of a given object by looking at them from different vantage points.
We don't have much time, but you keep on coming back to symmetry, and as I understand it, people are attracted to physically to other people if their faces, for example, are symmetrical. So this is pretty basic to human perception.
I think it is, and I think one reason we find symmetry beautiful is that evolution encourages us to find things that help us find our way around the world, or, as you say, to find desirable mates that are healthy, to find them beautiful. They stimulate our dopamine system, and that really, as a physiological level, is the source of beauty.
Frank Wilczek will be in conversation with Glenys Ferrar at Pioneer Works for the series Scientific Controversies tonight at 7:30 p.m. That's at 159 Pioneer Street in Brooklyn. You can find out more information on our show page at WNYC.org. His book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design, is published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.